At 25 minutes after the hour on this therapeutic Tuesday. Oh, wait, no, therapeutic Thursday. This is a transcendent Tuesday is what it is. This is a day when we rise above it all here. We're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don, a biochemist, a member of the board at Creation Moments, and a guy with a world of experience in pharmaceuticals and vintnering. Did I just invent a word? Vintnering. Is it a verb?
I think you did, yes.
Okay.
I think so, yeah. I don't think it can be a transitive verb.
Valle de la Pace is his winery and vineyard in Garden Valley, Texas, which is a beautiful place, by the way. If you ever get into Central Texas, you want to stop by just north of Tyler there. Take a look at Garden Valley.
Don, I had relatives over the weekend. I spent weekend with my relatives.
Yeah.
I actually have some.
Kinfolk.
My own relatives.
Kith and kin, eh?
Really, not in-laws, but direct relatives. Mm-hmm. People related just to me. And Carol was the in-law. And they said, they can't grow grapes in Texas, can they? Can they? What grapes in Texas? Oh, no, it can't be. It can't be. Nobody can grow grapes in Texas. No. And I said, oh, yeah. Oh, are you wrong?
It's a flourishing industry in Texas. It is.
You may be related to me, but you're still wrong. I got proof. I got living proof of a friend of mine's got a winery of his very own.
Yeah, it's some excellent. And by the way, you can link to Don's website on ours at thebrokenroadradio.com. It's the Valle de la Pace logo over there to the right, and it'll show you what he does and what he makes. And his biochemistry comes in very handy, not only in making wine, but in helping us isolate topics to discuss every Tuesday morning, which Don has been doing with us now for going on about 8.5, 9 years. And we really appreciate his time. Don, I found this one on monkeypox, and it was just kind of an alert, like a flag went up. And it's an Epoch Times article, and the headline is Fauci Issues Warning on Monkeypox in the U.S. And I'll just read the first paragraph. He said that the federal government needs to take it seriously as cases have risen across the world. Monkeypox. About 1,800 probable or confirmed cases across the country as of July 15th. Now, that's cases, not deaths. What's monkeypox, should we be alerted to a national pandemic here?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Well, if Fauci says so,
I mean,
you know.
He is sounding the alarm, preparing us for another potential shutdown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, federal emergency, and, of course, the World Health Organization is considering another global alert on monkeypox.
Yeah, they're holding a meeting on it this week. So,
yes. So, the total number of cases in the U.S., as you said, is 1,800. The total in the world is about 9,000. And the thing about monkeypox is that it is not transmitted like a virus, like the coronavirus was, that is, through one's breath, but it is transmitted through bodily fluids. Mm. So if you really want to know the story behind the monkeypox, it was primarily in Africa, North and Central Africa, and affected the younger population and in particular the homosexuals. And most of the cases, even in this country, are men. Even in New York City, for example, 336 reported cases in the city, 321 are men, 60% of the cases are homosexuals or of the LGBT community.
Is this a virus? Monkeypox, is it a virus? Or bacteria?
I'm pretty sure it's a virus. I could be wrong on that. It's like smallpox, you know, and chickenpox. But it's the thing is, it's not airborne. It's exchanged through bodily fluids. So you know, if you have it and you have sex with your wife, of course you know she could get it. But, you know, just it goes to show you that the community that is being most affected is that community that is having close bodily contact with one another. So this is not going to be a pandemic or, you know, spread like the coronavirus. See,
but I'm thinking that between the World Health Organization and the CDC and the NIH and the FDA and all those, there's like an industry that thrives when there's a pandemic. And they need something new to work with.
Yes. Well, and the most... the critical of all that is that the global community needs a pandemic to keep people, you know, in a state of fear so that they can obviously control them. And I think that is what they're trying to generate here, a new fear, because people are kind of, well, okay, there's still a war in Ukraine. Russia is still doing damage and people are fighting. But that's not in the news anymore, so let's generate some news items that we can, you know, hopefully get people in a state so that we can put in more restrictions. I believe that that's what this is all about. It's not a, you know, not a pandemic. That won't be a pandemic, and most people are going to be perfectly safe from this.
See, I get the feeling pandemic has no basis in science. There's no numbers. They just have to declare it a pandemic.
Well, that's right. And that's what they're, you know, I mean, even the World Health Organization, for example, is considering. They have a panel that they're going to be discussing this. Is this at the global health emergency level or not? And so there is absolutely no reason for it to be. You know, people need to know about it, but I don't know if there is a vaccine yet for monkeypox, like there is for.
But it's like flu symptoms, right? It's not. I haven't heard any report of deaths from monkeypox.
I haven't either. Doesn't necessarily mean that there hasn't been, but yes, it's a flu-like symptoms. You get, of course, you get the pox.
Gets ugly on your skin.
On your skin, yeah. At various places, and you feel sick. You know, you feel like you've got the flu, and so your immune system is trying to fight the stuff off, and you know, eventually it will, just like. People who got chicken pox. I can remember when I was growing up and going to school, you know, you got vaccinated against various things, and one of them was smallpox and chicken pox, and I think I even before I even got vaccinated for chicken pox, I even got chicken pox. And so you didn't go to school, you broke out with a couple of pox here and there. You didn't feel all that great, but, you know, everybody survived.
Yeah, well, there was a time, and I'm a little older than you are, so in the 50s, when something like this happened, chicken pox was one, measles was another one, moms would have parties with their young kids so they would get it and develop immunity and get over
it. That's when monkey pox was first discovered, in the 50s.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Well, it was in Africa, though, and we weren't there,
1958, and it was discovered in the lab in monkeys.
Okay, that's hence the name.
Had been collected for experimentation.
One of the early symptoms is you have a craving for bananas.
Yep. Yeah. Right.
You know you have monkey pox as opposed to smallpox.
If chicken pox, it would be like birdseed. Then you'd know the difference.
Okay, you guys. All right, listen up now. Listen, WHO is going to rename it to avoid the kinds of things you were just doing. You were just making fun.
Yeah. All right.
You were making fun. Shame. Shame. Mm-hmm. You were making fun. And the WHO wants to rename monkeypox to avoid discrimination.
Do they have a suggestion for it?
HMPXB.
Oh.
Hmpexabib.
That sounds very scientific.
Yeah. It's going to be called Hmpexab.
Okay. Okay. There's another article that caught my attention. Don, this is one you brought up, and it's from Newsweek. I have a link link in the chat window at Broken Road Radio if anybody would like to follow on. So I have to ask you, in reading this article, it looks to me for all the world like evolutionists are waving a white flag. Is that the case?
Oh, no. They wouldn't wave
They're
a white flag.
They're not ready to throw
they
in the towel.
They should wave a white flag and say, okay, we give up. But the article, of course, starts off saying that, hey, more and more people are not believing in God. And when I say more, those who believe in God in the United States, for example, in America, are still 81%, but that was a 10% drop over a decade ago. And some surveys and studies were done to find out why, and it looks like from a Pew Research poll, it's the 18 to 29 year olds are disproportionately represented in the so-called nuns, that is the atheist, agnostic, or religious unaffiliated, and which is not surprising because, you know, that's the age group that's going to college, and in college you are indoctrinated with socialistic ideas, if not communistic ideas, which is absolutely built on evolution and the idea that there isn't a God. So you are indoctrinated on all of that, and the science that you are taught, pure science, chemistry or physics, that's one thing. But, the science that you that you're taught that we have evolved and that there's plenty of evidence for evolution is all hogwash and not actually based on the actual true science. So atheists years ago said, well, you know, the universe, for example, has always been there, will always be there, and so we don't have to worry about a beginning. So the atheists and the evolutionists say, well, there was no beginning, and lo and behold, we get some bigger telescopes, and we're looking out into space and find out that, hey, you know what? It looks like there was a beginning to the universe, and all of the evidence now strongly points to the fact that there was a beginning to the universe. And if there is a beginning, then who began it? And so that's the logical question to answer. And of course, someone like Stephen Hawking, for example, gave the birth and rebirth and multi-universes and multiverse theories and all theoretical postulations based on mathematical models, none based on actual data. So people say, well, you know, Stephen Hawking is a very smart guy, and then you've got the skeptic Michael Schumer, who was going around campuses and proclaiming his skepticism for a god, and the popular guy Bill Nye, for example,
the science
and
guy,
others, yeah. Of course, the science guy, once he veers off into the origins, is not very scientific. Then Richard Dawkins, of course, everybody's familiar with. He and Dawkins, one of Dawkins' famous phrases is, "The universe was observed has precisely the properties we should expect. At a bottom, there is no purpose, no design, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference," which, you know, couldn't be further from the truth, because, one, like I said, the universe had a beginning. Two, the universe is extremely fine-tuned. The physical properties of the universe, for example, the strong and weak nuclear forces, that is, the forces that hold the atoms into and all the subatomic particles in place, those forces, if they were either stronger or weaker, you wouldn't be able to make any atoms. And of course, without atoms, you couldn't have anything else. And so those are finely tuned. The electromagnetic forces are extremely finely tuned. A little bit here or there would jar things out of proportion.
Well, and the key is here, there's so many independent factors that need to be perfect. That is independent in the sense that one is not dependent on the other. So it suggests that there was a fine tuner behind all this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everything was fine-tuned, especially fine-tuned for life. So, you know, it's one thing to have inert matter, but it's another thing to be able to have the molecules of life that we have. And those are extremely dependent on the electromagnetic forces, for example. You know, without carbon and its properties and oxygen and its properties and nitrogen and hydrogen, without their properties, life would not exist. And they have to be extremely fine-tuned. So all of that, yes, points to the fact that if the universe is not random, as evolution would say, and not just haphazard, but is extremely fine-tuned, then that points to a somebody had to fine-tune it, and you can give the person various names, but of course we like to call him Creator God.
I have a question about this too. And in this article, they quote Cambridge astrophysicist Sir Fred Hoyle, who I've heard about, and he argued, and I'll quote from him here: "A common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics to make life possible." Now, in that statement, it seems like he sets physics apart. He doesn't credit the super intellect with inventing physics, but monkeying with it, that somehow he was an interloper, that he was walking by one day, saw physics and said, "Oh, I think I'll tweak that," rather than having invented. Now, I may be reading too much into the statement, but there's a basic difference there, even with a designer approach to the universe, that's not the same as a creator. And we believe, as Christians, in a creator God, not just someone who tinkered with it, you know, found it out of tune and decided to fix it, but someone who actually invented it from nothing.
Well, yes, of course. If you read the books of Genesis, if you read Genesis from page one, it clearly tells us who actually created everything. And even in, as we've talked about on this program, the first day of creation, the first thing he has to do is create this substance that kind of looks like water, has the properties of water, but it's formless and void, and which I like to equate to the space-time that we all live in. And of course, it's the space-time. It's the, you know, that is not nothing, but is the essence of all of the physical universe that we see today. And of course, he spoke it into existence.
You bring up a point there too that I need to address, because the Bible says water, but it may be, you know, that would be a translation from the original Hebrew word, which may mean be simply the best description they had for whatever that substance was. And we take it literally as water, but you made the point that it was something like water. Maybe the language problem is one of the challenges we deal with, that we can't all read it in Hebrew, and we can't all understand that in Hebrew, an individual word might have a dozen or two dozen meanings. They approximate, not as specific as our Greek-based thinking here.
And, of course, you got to understand that people had had absolutely no concept of relativity and the properties of space and all of that stuff. And so the common term, we like to you know, why we like to think about is, okay, what is the characteristics of this that God is trying to describe to Adam, for example, because he would have told him, you know, exactly how things were created, but he can only go so far without giving him a supernatural mind to see, you know, kind of a playback of the whole process. So while, yes, the literal word is water, and it's the same word that's used further in the chapter when it talks about God separated the waters from below the expanse to above the expanse, and then the dry land appeared out of the waters, out of the seas. And so all of those words are the same. But I believe the first part is actually talking about space-time. But be that as it may, I mean, you know, the universe is highly fine-tuned and, you know, to the point that folks are calling it the Goldilocks universe. That is, everything is, one might say, perfect for life, and it's we have a fortunate universe, because without the properties that we have, like I said, life would not exist. You've got a fine-tuned universe. You have a beginning. You know, the universe, there was a beginning. There's no questioning that now. Some folks call it the Big Bang. Exactly how God did it, we still don't know. But we do know that the universe has a beginning. Now, will the universe have an end? Well, there again, you have to go back to Scripture, and it says that the universe, the space will be rolled up like a cloud, like a scroll, and things will be burnt up. So this physical universe that we see, there will be an end to it after the 1,000-year millennial period, when Jesus returns and rules and reigns on earth. And after his 1,000-year rule and reign, and you have the second big battle, if you will, global battle, this time against Jesus personally. And that time, there will be new heavens and new earth, and the old will pass away. But the other thing that should point people, especially the young folks, if they really are critical thinkers, and that's the problem. I think young folks today aren't learning to think critically. They're just memorizing and regurgitating the information that their professors are teaching them in college, whereas instead of, you know, the professors asking questions, well, how do you think this came about? And an individual needs to kind of wrestle with it themselves. They just tell them, oh, you know, it evolved. And then how do we know it evolved? Well, because we're here, so therefore we had to evolve. And that's a ridiculous answer to the question is where did we come from? But the third area that is really, you know, the most complex of everything, not that the universe is not complex, but is molecular, this area of molecular biology and the biology of life, or the biology of living cells. You know, from this, of course, you know, Watson and Crick discovered the structure for the DNA and figured out the codes. You know, from that, we have the RNA and the messenger RNA and tRNAs and all the mechanisms of the cell then that make a cell and reproduce and do all the functions within the cell. Well, it turns out that the deeper we look into the cell, we find out that, hey, this is not just a blob of protoplasm, for example, that of gooey, you know, chemicals and proteins and sugars and that type of stuff. This is actually a highly structured organ, a highly structured thing, and nothing is left to chance. There is scaffolding all throughout the cell, and there are these things of molecular machines that actually are made up, some of them 40 to 50 different types of specific proteins, that if one protein is defective, then the whole machine breaks apart, and guess what? Then the life of the cell, you know, is going to die. So, and you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of these molecular machines inside a cell, and that cannot be explained by just random chance, because like I said, in order to produce these specific proteins, you need a specific DNA sequence, which then needs to get translated into the messenger RNA, and then you need all the mechanisms for building the protein and then for assembling the proteins into these molecular machines. So life is extremely complex, and the more we look, the more it screams a creator God, as opposed to, oh, we just put these chemicals in a test tube and electrified it with a little bit of electric current and with ammonia, and voila, we get some amino acids and some very, very primitive nucleotides, and so therefore we think, oh, this is how life started here on Earth, which is absolutely foolishness.
So really, to summarize, there are three major areas of scientific discovery that have come about basically since the 1960s that turns the old interpretation of science on its ear and says that evolution and the people who thought there was no rhyme or reason to this, well, they've been proven wrong. And the question now is, when does this new, these new discoveries, the new scientific trends soak into the public consciousness? Because the evolutionists still seem to have control of the means of communication. I'm trying to avoid the word media. But they're still the ones that get published, not the people who have been behind and elaborated on these three scientific trends.
Well, and unfortunately, you know, most of the folks in the most of the professors in the universities are not. I wouldn't say then. You know, they're not creationists. They believe in evolution, and they stake their life on the evolution. So whatever they're teaching, even if they're talking about DNA, for example, in the fact that, hey, you know, the human genome is 3 billion base pairs, and you know, they're not going to say that those 3 billion base pairs have to be in a specific sequence in order for life to exist, but they do. Now, not all of those 3 billion, you know, base pairs for the human genome code for proteins, for example, and that's because you need the rest of the information to for control, and for to tell the cell when to express what protein and where. So, I think I blame primarily the universities, and now it's being pushed down all the way down to grammar school. From the very beginning, kids start learning science, they're being told that evolution, yes, okay, it's a proven fact, which is an absolute lie.
You know, we've talked about updating textbooks before. You were a major part of that in Texas years ago, trying to get certain things removed from textbooks that that portray evolution in a way that never happened, that were actually, you know, graphic designer inventions, not scientific inventions, like the march of the monkey to the upright man, getting rid of that graphic. And so maybe that fight just needs to go on. We've been talking with Dr. Don Clark, member of the board at Creation Moments. You can link to them from our website, their website, creationmoments.com, and they've got lots of scientific information that supports and explains the biblical story of creation. That is in a scientific way that you can relate to on a rational basis, not just a theological basis. But it all goes together to tell the same story. We have a creator God, and he's got a plan and a purpose for each of us. Don, thanks
it
so much.
Might be interesting to know, too, that Bill Nye, the science guy, is not a scientist. He's a mechanical engineer.
He's a showbiz guy right now.
And he does a TV program.
Don, thanks so much. We appreciate the time you've given us, and we'll look forward to next week.
Okay, sounds good. You folks have a great week.
We'll see you then. Bye-bye.